What is going on, everyone? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. This is episode 55, and I'm talking to Greg. I'll do a little confession here off the start, and I'll go ahead and say that there are significant moments in my life where I struggle with if God is actually even doing anything. Maybe that's just me. Maybe I'm out on an island here, but man, it can seem like sometimes like maybe God's spoken and just like nothing's happening, or that like I always feel like I know what God should be doing and he won't. And I feel like those seasons of life are really hard for me. I feel like I struggle with doubts at times, and I feel like I'm probably not alone in that. I would say that stories like you're about to hear are ones you should listen to in those seasons. Greg has this amazing story of God sort of calling him overseas and into missions unwillingly, and then pulling the rug out from under him completely, and kind of reorienting his whole life around orphan care. It's like the coolest story. He has done some amazing things. He starts a company as a retail analyst and uses influence that he has in the retail community to launch this amazing nonprofit that he runs called Retail ROI. It's just awesome. You're gonna love hearing about his story. We talk all about some trials that God has put him through over the years. We see that whole story sort of unfolded. We also talk about what it's like as a Christian to run a secular nonprofit, and I think the trials that sort of come from that. And so you get a lot of different pictures of what God has done with Greg's life. You see some of his struggles, some of the trials, and I think you just see the beauty of God's story that was always in place from the beginning, but that you can't see until you take that like view out, till you zoom out and you see the whole story. So I think you're going to be really encouraged by this story. I think you're going to be challenged by this story. And I think you're just going to really enjoy hearing from Greg. He's a great guy and is doing some amazing things in this world. And it is all because that's what God has him doing. So you're going to love it. Make sure if you get a second to go ahead and rate and review me on iTunes or whatever app you use to listen to your podcast. It helps get the word out. I know I say this every week, but I do appreciate it. Those of you who have taken time to review me, that helps a lot. And I read all those, and they really mean a lot to me. It means a lot that you listen and that, you know, these stories mean something to you. I always appreciate the encouragement. You can always follow me over at Theology of Hustle on Instagram or Facebook. I'm always showing pictures of my very cute kids and talking theology over there. So make sure you're following me, and I hope you enjoy this interview with Greg. All right. Well, Greg, I can't say thanks enough for, coming on the podcast and chatting with me a little bit. I'm excited.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's good to be with you.
Yeah, awesome. So let's just jump off here and have you introduce yourself to everybody.
Hi, my name's Greg Buzik. I'm president of an IT analyst firm called IHL Group. And then I lead a charity called the Retail Orphan Initiative, which is a group of people in the retail industry that are helping orphans and vulnerable kids around the world.
Okay, there you go. All right, so you have a really interesting story to how you got to Retail Orphan Initiative, mm-hmm. right? So can we dig back through some of that story a little
sure.
bit? Awesome.
Sure. Well, it's a mixture of professional and spiritual journey that got back to a professional thing that's kind of merged together.
Well, you're in the right place. Theology yeah. Hustle, that's perfect, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So it's really a fascinating story in my mind anyway. So to give a little background to me, I'm a father as well with a beautiful wife and two kids. One is graduating in like 6 weeks there as well. But back in my single days, I was working for a company called Sensormatic Electronics as a product development manager. And truth be told, I wasn't a very good product manager, but I happened to be very fortunate to work on a product that is now in every Walmart, Kmart, Home Depot. Yeah, those guys plus countless others that deactivate security tags.
Oh, okay.
When you go through. So when you purchase an item, there's a deactivator that deactivates those tags and it so that the pedestals don't go off when you try to leave the stores.
Right.
Very fortunate to work on that product at a tipping point for the technology of what they call source tagging, which is putting the tags in the products themselves.
Okay.
So that they're not on the outside of the products, but they're embedded in the products. So a little bit of that history is I started getting very, very involved in my church roughly the same time. And we had all kinds of issues with that product before we released. It was the first product that was going to be using a surface mount technology versus a through-hole technology. So from a manufacturing standpoint, it was really risky. It also required a lot of power to be stored in a device that is thrown out at the point of deactivation. So
sure.
It uses a magnetic field and you're fighting gravity. So there you basically had a bunch of copper wire that would get charged by these capacitors at the point of deactivation, and that would throw a magnetic field up and deactivate the labels. When you compare those things together, a new production process, new boards, new everything along with that, it can be a little challenging. Yeah. And that's kind of where it got fun, because I, as a product manager, I had responsibility for the products, but I didn't have authority over the people that the divisions that had to come together to make it work. So we had engineering taking a very cautious approach because they were struggling with keeping them from blowing up in the factory. They literally had people in the factory turning them on with broom handles because a disconnect or the board or the connection in the board, if that wasn't correct and designed correctly, all that charged power would actually blow up the board.
Whoa.
When it was done in the early stages. Huh. It was also a very going to be a strategic product for us. We were going to sell it for $900 and it was going to cost $900 to build. The only problem was is they sold 10,000 of them to Home Depot.
Wow.
And engineering, they wanted 10,000 in the first month of production. And the engineering didn't want to have anything to do with that because of that. So these guys were fighting like crazy. And I remember going home one night and just praying, Lord, if you want this to happen, I need you to come in and do it, because I can't get these guys to work together and come to some conclusion. And that was on a Friday. And when I came back on Monday, it was like the lions laid down with the lambs. Everybody was agreeing and everybody was things. And it was like, wow, God's in this. And that really gave me a lot of confidence in the management of things. And we started proceeding. Our product cost dropped to $476 on the device from $900. So all of a sudden we were making, $400 to $500 on each one that went out there.
Wow.
And they found a manufacturing process that eliminated the problems in the factory. And miraculously, they ended up selling 100,000 of those units in the first year and went really well. So for me, that was kind of the, where Jesus is telling Peter, put your nets on the other side of the boat. And he's kind of like, yeah, right. I've been out here all day, et cetera. And it's like, well, if God can do that, with what happened in this project for me, I want to learn more and I want to get more involved. At the time, my boss was, we were trying to integrate with scanners at the time, which was really hard to do. It took a long time to finally convince those guys to integrate into scanners because they were worried about a magnetic field in their mirrors there, affecting the mirrors and the spinning rates and things like that and the lifetime of the units. But as well, he wanted to get that 4-inch field up to 12 inches because RF, that's the field of the scanner, and RF can do that. Our competitors, and this technology was having trouble. So I had, and he was really pressing hard on that. And I had one conversation with my engineer that explained Tesla's law, and essentially that to get to 12 inches, we would have had to remove all safety and essentially put the equivalent of MRI power in the lane.
Right.
to get there. So something else had to change. The label would have to change or whatever. Well, they didn't want to do that. And so my boss and I were going back and forth, et cetera. So my door got shut and, you know, and I was pushing back because I didn't want my name on it. I didn't want to go anywhere near it, as that is a potential risk with pacemakers and pregnant moms and all that sort of stuff in that environment. And there was a lot of other stuff. God was just working on me and, you know, putting me through a lot of paces for a lot of different things at that time. And, but I was excited about what was going on in my small group. People's lives were getting changed and I was walking deeper into my faith. And, I went to lunch one day with, our missions pastor. He was the missions and small group pastor. And at the time, I believe I'm 20, now maybe 30 years old at this point. And I told him, I said, Kelly, I really want to get more involved in the church. And in my ego, I thought, you know, that means, you know, he's going to ask me to do a small group, lead a small group, right, et cetera, and my ego and start my own little church and all that stuff. I was about 3 years in the Lord at the time. And he says, no, we need help in missions. And I said, forget about it. I mean, I'm a business guy. What does that have to do with missions?
Right.
And before I got back to my desk, I got fired. And that truly got my attention at that point, because I had time. I got a very generous severance package from the company. And I looked at it, I said, okay, I can do like a week mission trip or go somewhere. And I just kept getting this impression that I was supposed to go for longer. And to cut the story a little short, I had narrowed it down, even though most of my friends had gone to Mexico or Bahamas or the Caribbean or someplace for mission trips and being in South Florida, it kept coming back to Africa. And as I'm going through that, our church was involved in two areas in Africa. One was Kenya and the other one was Liberia. And I was taking a class called the Obedient Life class as an adult education opportunity. And it just so happens that a young lady who just got back from Kenya came. So I sat and talked to her about her experience. And in my heart, I knew Kenya was not the place that I was supposed to go. And I'm like going, gosh, you got to be kidding me. Liberia? All I know about Liberia is that they've been, you know, they're about to go into civil war. Right. Chet's over there. He's had an AK-47 pointed at him by an 8-year-old. He's had malaria 3 times. Lots of instability. I mean, if that's what I'm supposed to do, I need like a burning bush. Right. I need a burning bush. And I'm praying this prayer driving up I-95 in South Florida, 6 lanes of traffic on either side, 10:30 at night. And I pass Palmetto Park Boulevard, which is just north of where I worked. And I see this guy pushing his car up the side of the road on the right side. And I'm like, what's going on? And I blow on past. It'd been a long day and everything. And I felt this tug in my heart go around and help that guy. So I had to go up the next exit and turn off and pull around and come back around. And as I pull up there, he's got a bumper sticker that says, I support Liberia.
What?
On the bumper sticker. You know, and so I give him a ride home going, you're not going to believe this, but I was praying about going to Liberia. And he, of course, he's escaped the wars there and he thinks I'm crazy, but I end up dropping this guy off. I never see him again, never talk to him again, but I'm sitting there going, whoa, I had got a burning bush. Yeah. And then I remember our senior pastor, Chuck Smith, sharing, you know, when it comes to life decisions, beware of signs and wonders. Make sure you have scripture to back up life decisions. And you've got the confirmation of the word with the spirit and, you know, other people as well. And like I said, other people have been telling me Africa. So that piece had been happening. And I get this bumper sticker there, but I didn't have any scripture. And so I was like, cool, this is my get out of Liberia free card. I don't want to go to Liberia. Here, but I went back to the class the next week and I got hit with the first scripture and 6 in a row. The first scripture was Genesis 12, you know, God's call to Abram, leave your country, your father's household, go to the land I will show you. And I was like, I'm like going, yeah, but who am I? I mean, I'm a business guy. I'm not a missionary. A missionary's up on a pedestal. And I flipped the page in the notes. And the next verse was Moses said, who am I? I should go to Pharaoh and everything. And it finally came down as just like, yeah, but I've got all these things. And he says, well, I'll send Aaron and I'll send, you know, and all this stuff. And it finally got to a point and I just said, you know what? I don't want to go. Send somebody else. And of course, that's the next verse. Moses said, send somebody else. And then I was reading my Bible. The next verse said, and the Lord's anger burned at Moses.
Oh, man.
And I went, oh, my gosh, I am going to Liberia as a missionary for a year. So I can remember clear as day, the Cleveland Browns were playing the Steelers on Monday Night Football. We used to have these Monday Night Football parties. And I'm sitting at my buddy Todd's house, our apartment, in the back, and my heart is just beating out of my chest and just unbelievable that I'm going to be going to Liberia and my life has just radically changed. So I take all the steps to plan to go to Liberia, including a 16-week training course they threw in there at the last minute that met once a week, took several odd jobs, one of which being a small business accountant, which taught me a lot of accounting and finance things that I would need later. And then the only thing that's left after all of that is I need it to sell my house to go away. So I get an offer on my home on Friday. On Saturday, the offer falls through. And on Sunday, Liberia goes into civil war and all ports are closed inside and out and I can't go.
Wow.
And so at that point, you know, this spiritual journey became one of, okay, I thought I was going in this direction and now I've got to get a job and I've got to do something. So I was looking at different job opportunities and a friend of mine at NCR hired me to do some work on their product release process, some competitive intelligence on what the others in the industry were doing. And I did that pretty well. I used to do that at NCR years ago. So I started that. And then after about the first year or so, I said, you know what? I think this, you know, this contract's probably going to come to an end. I got to figure out a way to turn this into a business that's more ongoing. So we started some syndicated research on the point of sale industry and other retail sizing, and then had customers like Intel and 3Com and folks like that that came on board along with NCR and others. So that's how our business started. Literally in 1996 and for IHL. Now we're 23 years into that business. 2 years, 3 years into that business, I met my wife, Michelle, in the singles group. So we get married. I've been through this whole thing on what the missions thing or business intersection with missions or anything. I had no clue. All I knew is I was going in this direction and the door slammed shut.
Right.
So Michelle and I, we wanted to move. As we got married, we have kids, and South Florida just wasn't the place we wanted to raise our children, particularly the part of South Florida that we were in. I always joke with everybody, it's like the Seinfeld episode when Kramer runs for Homeowners Association in the retirement village. That's the part of Florida where we lived. And Del Boca Vista, and it's a play on word between Del Rey and Boca Raton, and that's kind of essentially where we live. Okay. And we end up moving to, right after our son Gabriel was born, we moved to Tennessee, here in Franklin, Tennessee. So we're kind of in the hub of the music world up here. Nice. Secular and faith-based music here. I'm probably the worst musical person here in the area. But it's a great place to raise our family. And the business, after about 3 years, 4 years, was starting to take off. So Michelle and I had kind of put the vision together of we wanted to be able to give back through the business. And James 1:27 talks about pure and undefiled religion is this, to care for widows and orphans in their distress, or visit widows and orphans in their distress. So we kind of put that into a business plan that we had, and that once we hit certain financial goals through the business, we wanted to do more specifically for widows and orphans. Now, it came up along the way, you know, through our giving. Our giving went up tremendously during that time, but it wasn't necessarily focused on widows and orphans,
right,
until we got this next part of the journey. So literally, I'm still going through this this piece on my faith that has kind of alienated me in a way, not understanding what that was all about. What I came to realize is I was supposed to support Liberia in some way, not be a missionary and go there. The bumper sticker said support Liberia. And you know, as I went through and I realized you can be the person who goes, you can be a person that supports, you can be a person, you know, and that encourages. There's all kinds of roles. You can play logistics, all kinds of roles there. So we hit one of those financial goals in 2007. Actually, it was October of 2007 that we hit that thing. January 4th of 2008, our pastor started teaching out of the same scripture: leave your country, your father's household, go to the land I will show you. And there's a bunch of promises in that area of scripture for Abram that, you know, I just completely dismissed. You know, this can't possibly be me. But as I started reading those, I will bless those who bless you. I'll curse those who curse you. I'll make your name great. And in my own little world as a retail analyst, I had seen God do that. I had seen things where all of a sudden I got promoted and you know, and got accolades that I'm like, you know, the big thing is I got changed from a consultant to an analyst in one publication. And then instead of begging to get into the parties, I was getting invited to all the parties.
Right, right. It's crazy how fast that can happen, right?
It really is strange. I get to live like a rock star for 4 days a year in New York. And but there was, I had one of these experiences on the next verses where it's a messianic promise of the coming of Christ, where in the first Bible edition I was reading, it said, and all the peoples of the earth will be blessed. But I had a situation where the word families jumped off the page at me, like double bold 14 font when everything else is an 8 font, you know?
Right.
And I'm like, what's going on here? Families. And so at the same time, my son was getting ready to play flag football. And I was going to be a coach. And at the local YMCA, they were having a draft for the players so that the teams could somewhat be even at skill level and things like that. And there was a gentleman that just was there. He was over his head trying to figure out how to coordinate this, or he was completely distracted. I wasn't sure which there. And I offered to help because I was a grad assistant at Ohio State in a recreation intramural program. And we had 1,800 teams, you know.
You're like, I've done this a time or two.
Eight teams should be pretty easy. Right. Here to do that. So I reached out to him and got to, you know him a little bit on that Friday and help him through that process. And on Monday, he sends out an email to everybody that he's resigning because he's doing something with families. So I'm like, oh, I have to pursue this. So I reached out to Brent and I told my story and he told me his journey there, and that he was working with families on no interest adoptions because the government gives tax credits for adoption, but it doesn't give you that money until after the adoption is completed, and the adoption can be very costly.
And over 5 years, yeah, right? Exactly. It's not like a lump sum.
Right, exactly. So he was working with an organization called Family Legacies to provide these no interest loans so the adoptions could get done. And that finally merged in with Life Song for Orphans eventually. But after talking to Brent, literally the next day, I get a phone call from a lady back in Florida that when I was single, I led a small group at our singles retreat. And she approached me. She says, I'm a guardian ad litem in the system. Do you think Pastor Bob could have a house, a safe place for these kids to come when they get pulled from their homes? Because they have to... When a child gets pulled from foster care from their home, they get a garbage bag, and most often the first night or two, they have to sleep on the administration floor because there's no safe place for them to go. Yeah. And my part in this is literally saying, sure. Right. You know, well, she goes off to start something called Child Share, which ends up becoming 4 Kids of South Florida. And 10 years later, she's actually working with Tony Dungy and Eddie DiBartolo to do the Super Bowl breakfast.
Wow.
And the prayer Super Bowl prayer breakfast. And she did a Google search and my name popped up. And she calls me out of the blue. I haven't talked to her for like 8 years. And she goes, "Hey, remember that, you know, when we started Child Share and Four Kids and stuff?" He says, "Well, we've had more adoptions through the program than any program in the country."
Whoa. Wow.
And I'm getting this award and they're having this like banquet type thing for me in Florida at this conference. Can you come down? And that was the Christian Alliance for Orphans conference, CAFO.
Yeah.
And I'm like, "Okay, yeah, I'll come down and support you on that. That's really great." And so I called Brent back and said, "Hey, have you heard about this conference called, you know, CAFO?" And he's like, "Yeah, my whole family's going." So I end up at this conference in Fort Lauderdale in April, May of 2008. And the first speaker, have no clue why I'm there other than supporting my friend. First speaker is Kay Warren, Rick Warren's wife. And she was talking about her experience in Rwanda and just through tears talking about how her heart's breaking, how she's no fun at cocktail parties anymore because she can't small talk. And that just broke my heart. And then Dennis Rainey got up there. And the first thing he did that got my attention is I'm an analyst all day, so I do numbers all day and try to make sense of numbers. He shared that a child dies every 5.2 seconds around the world due to famine, disease, or whatever. Gosh. So I start doing the math going, okay, that's 11 every minute, blah, 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 blah. It's 3 times 9/11 every month that the number of people that died to 9/11 we lose in children. And for, you know, that haunted me for 4 months after this. But what really grabbed my heart was a quote from Winston Churchill. And that quote is, obviously it was for World War II. He said, "There comes into the life of every man a cause for which he is uniquely suited. Woe to that man if he's either unwilling or unprepared for that which may become his finest hour."
Wow.
And it was like, this whole journey has been about helping orphans and stuff, not necessarily missions. It could have a missions piece to it, but it's really about helping orphans and vulnerable kids. So a couple months later, like I said, I can't sleep because the numbers are just going in my head and we got to do something. I was in a leadership meeting at our current church and a gentleman, Craig May, had just gotten back from a trip to the Ukraine where he worked with orphans there. And I just blurted out all the statistics. I couldn't keep it in anymore. He says, "We've got to do something because, you know, this is how many kids die, blah, blah, blah." And my pastor just looked at me and goes, "I highly encourage you to pursue this path and do something." So we ended up starting a ministry at our church for adoption, foster care, supporting some orphanages in China and some other things. And that was blossoming. And I was going to Oracle Open World, just one of my business conferences. And there was a gentleman by the name of Paul Singer that was there. And so Paul is the gentleman that took over for Dave Thomas of Wendy's, lobbying Congress for money for foster kids and adoption when Dave died. And Paul was the CIO of Target Stores. And then he was the CIO of Super Value, which Dominick's and many other, and Albertsons and many other stores at the time we met. And we met and he said, "You know, wouldn't it be great if we could do something as an industry together?" At that time, you know, everything's booming, had been booming up to that point. And there were a lot of mergers, acquisitions. SAP and Oracle were buying all the technology companies at the time. And so wouldn't it be great if we didn't just compete all the time, that we could actually come together and do something for a greater good? And so he and I agreed in that. We walked outside. We saw six other people, one of them being Mark Milstein. But Rose Spicer was there, and Jeff Roster, and Kathy Martyr, and I think Kathy Hodka might have been there. We're all there, and just friends that we see every show, that we just get together for beers with at every show. And we said, "Let's do something together. And they all agreed, let's go do something. So Mark, myself, and Paul, we became the original donor trustees and put the money in. We put like $9,000 into the pot. We signed the paperwork, just assume Paul's going to lead this. I mean, he's the guy. He started the Congressional Coalition on Adoption Institute. He started several charities. That he would be the guy that would lead this as a CIO in our industry. And so we signed the paperwork on Friday and send the money in. On Monday, Paul calls me and he says, Greg, I don't know how to tell you this, but I got a call from my doctor. I've been having these headaches and I have got a brain tumor. Oh. And I have surgery next Monday. And Paul had surgery and they had to take out part of his hippocampus that affected his ability to speak and read. And he was never really to come back from that, you know, over about an 18-month period before he passed away. So, you know, it fell to me at that point, okay, I'm leading this thing in the industry. And it very much felt like somebody like Gideon. I'm the least qualified of anybody in the industry to lead this because, you know, I've got a small group of like 8 people.
Yeah. You
know, and we're talking about a $4.5 trillion industry at the time. And it's like, what are we going to do? So thankfully in January at our major trade show, which is National Retail Federation show, a friend, Dick McRedman, who was with IBM, offered us on a Sunday morning, a conference room to just get together and figure out what to do. And they said, Paul and I had come up with the name Retail ROI. It's just simply a play on words, a return on investment.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, Retail Orphan Initiative. We're just going to be a bunch of friends and geeks to do something. And we sat there then in January, those of us that were in the meeting, and we said, okay, guys, we've got a charity that's now bleeding cash. We have to figure out a way to raise money. How can we raise money? And we looked around the room and everybody around the room did events for a living. Sure. We all know who the best speakers are. We know who, how to organize an event, all that stuff. And I said, what if we put together an analyst event where we brought in the top speakers that we've seen in the last year to give their speeches for free? We invite retailers for free who would be buying technology, and we sell sponsorships and only access to vendors to those retailers through sponsorships. And it says, okay, great. So Microsoft had a room credit at the Marriott Eastside in New York that they let us use. And we had our first session the following year, the day before NRF, and we called it Super Saturday. So that was our first session. It would have been in 2010 was our first session.
Wow.
And so since then, it's been a ride, to say the least. It's now, we work in 100, we've done 193, actually it's more than that now, but I think 193 projects in 24 countries around the world, helping an estimated 226,000 kids that we can estimate. So we do three things. One, for Retail ROI, our primary goal is to, you know, first step is to raise awareness that there are these needs. Two is, as individuals and companies, that we can make a difference with our skill sets and our knowledge and our networks, very much so, to make a difference. So I'll give you an example. So we had a school in Honduras of 650 kids that fed the kids 4,300 tortillas a day, corn tortillas. And they were in a situation where they could either pay their teachers for the year with $80,000, or they could buy food for the kids for the year. And so my brother Mark works for Cargill. So I approached him and said, would Cargill donate 2 train cars of corn to this process? And he was able to convince them to do that. The only problem with that was that it came in, it was in the United States, and it was in individual kernels. So the gentleman that works in that corn division, hearing, he goes, you know what? I have a friend who has a seed packing business where they bag seed in 50-pound bags. let me see if I can convince them to, you know, take this on, bag it up for us and store it for us for a time being. And so they went to a company called Fisher Seeds, and Fisher Seeds donated that time and energy to do that. And then we had another lady, Brenda, who she does shipping containers for a living and logistics for a company. And so she secured the containers. Wow. She bought those. She scheduled the FDA inspections and all the things that you would need for customs. She organized the shipping, et cetera. And the entire shipment delivered in Honduras to the door for the school was $7,500. Wow. As a result, because we used our skill set. So that's number two. And then number three is we come alongside charities that are doing really great work. So we don't work with churches. We don't work with mosques. We can't do anything. It has to be a separate 501c3 charity, at least from a funding mechanism perspective in the U.S. And then they can be working all over the world. But the way our charter is we have to give money to that organization who then distributes for specific projects. So the order in which we do things is first is clean water. We get involved if there's a need for clean water, because if you don't have that, you can't do education or work or anything else.
Right. It's foundation.
Second is then education for the kids, building a school, building a building, protecting the kids, et cetera, would be next. And we've done that in several countries. And then third, we bring in technology. We've got a guy who's created basically a mobile internet lab in a box, a charity called Control Alt Delete Poverty. They've taken a Raspberry Pi and they've loaded that up with online content. So it acts like a mini web server that's offline with tablets, and basically in a carry-on suitcase, they can drop a 10 tablet computer lab anywhere in the world.
What?
Whether it's power or not. Yeah.
My gosh. Wow.
And so this is what happens when you unleash these really creative and successful people who are looking for significance, when you unleash them to just come alongside these charities. So we've had people that have joined boards and coming alongside there. And we've had companies like Intel and Microsoft and SAP and others, people go on trips there together, competitors that are on trips, but they're brainstorming to help kids and help organizations.
Yeah.
And a lot of our stuff, when we do trips, we do vision trips. You don't want me painting anything. You want me tearing down anything. But if we see, hey, there's a building that's needed, we can fund the jobs that are necessary in that country to build that building. A fun story. And you haven't asked any other questions, so I just
no. This is your story is fascinating. I'm about to. I have some questions, but okay. Yeah.
All right. Well, let me tell you how Liberian bumper sticker came into play, because it's really a miracle. So 2013, we started working with a charity in Liberia. I finally did get to go to Liberia. That's part of the story. And I've been four times now. But on one of our trips, we found out about an organization where they were going to have a girls' school. And we met with that organization and said, you know what, we can provide the computer lab for you.
Yeah.
So at the time, we didn't have this internet in a box thing yet. We had a bunch of Chromebooks. So we were donating the Chromebooks for the first year of operations. In the midst of fundraising for the second year, back in the United States, Ebola broke out in Liberia. And we had been trying to look at hiring somebody from an admin standpoint, but it's a rather unique position. It's somebody that's business savvy, that knows how to run a charity and runs charities and can do all the administration stuff, but also can lead trips and all the stuff. And we had not truly figured out what the job description was going to be or who the right candidates were at this time. So we had this chunk of money that was just kind of sitting in our account. Well, my friend went back to when all the other NGOs, they pulled out of Liberia because of Ebola and half the medical infrastructure was done. She went back to there. And so by going back, she called us in August of that year and said, hey, I said, what do you need? How can we help here? You know? And she says, we need an ambulance. There are only 4 ambulances in the entire country. It's a country the size of Delaware, and there's only 4 ambulances. And it's taking 4 days for an ambulance to show up to an infected person. So if you could imagine your local mall, and 100,000 people lived in that, and they were quarantined, and they couldn't touch each other, but Ebola was in the middle of that. That was the situation, and it was taking 4 days to get that infected person out of that environment. It's unbelievable, yeah, right, the catastrophe that could be. Yeah. And she said, we need an ambulance. And because I had a bumper sticker on I-95 to support Liberia, we wrote a check to help buy an ambulance. Wow. And they went in there, and we worked with several charities there. We estimate combined, they probably saved the lives of 30,000 people. By having an ambulance that could reduce the call rate to 30 minutes from 4 days. And so that's just one of the miraculous things that's happened. And we've had several others. We had the Nepal earthquake. We had a partner that had materials on the ground before the U.S. military did, to help victims. We had in Haiti during one of the hurricanes that came through, we had a charity down there that could get supplies to those in need. Before, like I said, any other organizations could really do that in the process. So that's been the journey. That's been the journey and some of the result.
I feel like maybe your story to me is ridiculous. And by that, I mean, like, how crazy it must have been. I think back to that time, like when you, lost your job, when you were trying to go to Liberia and couldn't, and you know, they closed the country. Like, if God had shown you a vision of like what you would be doing today, right? Like,
no, as well as the what I'd have to go through.
Yeah.
There's another piece of this on the character building and the stuff that's a story I've never really shared. In 2012, I went in for a replacement crown on a tooth. And this was right before a major trade show and before Super Saturday. And there was this sharp pain when they put the crown on. And I didn't think much of it because the pain went away because of the adrenaline, because of the events and all the stuff that was happening. Ended up that once we're done with that, the pain came back. I went in, got to get a root canal for it. Pain went away for a little bit, but then the pain came back, roaring back. Then I had the tooth extracted. And the pain came back again. And I remember seeing my friend Dwayne at a conference, and he looked at me and says, Greg, you're green. You look really sick. And when I started talking about my symptoms to doctors and how the pain was coming and going, the first thing I did was go to orthodontists, and they started testing my teeth and stuff. And the way they do it is they test one tooth and they test another tooth next to it. And if those are the same pain levels, they just assume everything's fine. And they take x-rays. And for your technology crowd, just to notice that the x-ray is a 1980s technology that's used in the dental offices.
Sure.
So think of the early VGA type of display, and that's what you get. So the x-rays came back. In the little test, they came back and said, there's nothing wrong with your teeth. There's nothing wrong with your teeth. So they think, we think you might have this thing called trigeminal neuralgia, which if you look it up on Wikipedia, says the suicide disease. And it was really a strange diagnosis, discouraging diagnosis. But that kind of planted the seeds for all these doctors, because the so-called expert dentists had ruled it out that it was teeth related, with their testing and technology. So it must be a neurology thing, because all that whole side of your face is all connected as a single nerve type thing,
sure,
trigeminal nerve stem. So they started treating me as if I had trigeminal neuralgia, and that the belief from the neurosurgeons were such that they felt that I had a vein that was impinging on that nerve. And every time my heart pumped, it was irritating that nerve. But one of the things that was unique is it was only painful, super painful, when I was upright. If I laid down, some of the pain would go away. It was brutal if I flew anywhere. Anyway, long story short, I went through brain surgery, and they opened me up and said, you don't have what we thought you had, but you have the angriest nerve we've ever seen. And this is a guy who's one of the NFL neurosurgeons now for PTE. Gosh. Because it's you've got the angriest nerve we've ever seen. And I was just in excruciating pain on heavy, heavy drugs. The stuff that killed Philip Seymour Hoffman and all these guys, I was on. I had a fentanyl patch. I was doing 6 hydrocodone a day, 8 tramadol a day. Ooh. And I'll be honest with you, the role of retail ROI and knowing that I was supposed to lead that, it's probably kept me alive during that period. But it was tough to be a dad, really tough to be a dad. Regret that. My kids, you know, basically lost their dad for 2 to 3 years during, you know, formative years. And finally got a diagnosis. I got a young dentist who did 3-dimensional x-rays of the teeth. And basically the bottom line is I had 2 teeth that were cracked. And 1 tooth had a leftover piece of a root canal tool in it that was in nerve. So when I was upright, it was pressing on the nerve. And over time, that's why the pain was never immediate. It was an hour later that would actually register if I had some cold or whatever. And once those 3 teeth were fixed, the pain finally went away.
No way.
In that journey. But, you know, I can't discount that the trials and the character building and the working in you has been necessity for the success that we've had as the charity and everything else on this, you know. And you know, that part of it, I've never shared that part of it, but literally the charity side of that and that calling, so to speak, has probably kept me alive during that time.
Gosh, that's staggering. I appreciate you being willing to share that. I mean,
no worries.
That's crazy.
If anybody has dental things or their teeth hurt or they've got nerve things, get a 3D x-ray.
No kidding. And it's amazing that like you had to have brain surgery before like they took a before they took like a 3D x-ray, something that was invented in the last, you know, 2 decades. So
yeah, and it was the young guy, right? The 35-year-old dentist, which was the guy that had the new technology and says, "Oh, sure, dude." He's like a surfer dude, you know?
Right. Like, yeah. Like, this guy's not going to be able to help me at all, but oh well.
Exactly. It was like, you're my last straw. I've been through all the 60-year-old, 70-year-old guys who know it all.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
It's amazing. Well, I appreciate you being willing to tell your story. It's amazing. It's amazing what God has done through this simple call. And like, I love seeing how the progression of like, he has to take you to a next step before something else can happen. You know, it's
right. Yeah. Right. And a lot of times you just don't know. What I learned is the word is a lamp to our feet. So God's given me kind of this big vision, but steps along the way are, you know, a daily reliance, because I have, every time I think this is the right way to go from a big vision standpoint, you know, I get into trouble.
Yeah. Right. Well, and like that lamp, like you said, or like, it reminds me of, give us this day our daily bread, right? It's not like bread till I'm, you know, 90. It's daily, and it's provision, and it's, He seems to never want to give me more than I need for that specific day, right?
Yeah.
That's good. That's good stuff. Well, dude, great story. I love it. I love the organization. I'm going to blast it. So send me anything that I can to, like, you know, show people what y'all do. And, you know, I'll put the website out there and all that. So.
Okay, will do.
Yeah. So, well, you ready to jump into our last 2 questions here?
Yeah.
So, all right. So my first question is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
You know what? We use this as an icebreaker, and mine's pretty boring compared to some friends' answers, but I'll give it to you. Mine was really a combination of two. When I was 18, during the day, I worked unloading trucks at Sears, and it was about 120, 130 degrees inside those trucks to unload the merchandise. And then at night, I started here first and then went to the trucks. I worked in an ice house where it was 14 degrees.
Wow.
And bagged ice. And we would do 8 pounds a second of stacking ice on pallets. So people could have it in their drinks and everything else. So that combination of going from 14 to 120 every day was quite a summer there.
No kidding.
Yeah, I've had some friends who have some doozy. that's a great icebreaker question for a group of people you don't know.
So. Yeah, for sure. No, I'm amazed. I haven't had anybody else really ask that question before. So it's a great icebreaker, right? Yeah. So, okay. So finally, then, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring the kingdom more into their work?
Great question. Honestly, I think it's just seek the Lord and be authentic about your own walk and your own faith, and don't separate, you know, church life from business life, from charity life, and all the other aspects of it. What turned the light bulb on for me originally was that God interjected into what mattered to me in my business life based on a problem, you know?
Yeah.
And because of that, I could do my job better and all of that sort of stuff. But I also began to listen better at the individual things that had that God was doing in my life. That's why the journey that I've been on has been there. And like I said, it was dead. It was definitely dead for 12 years. You know, when I couldn't go to Liberia, and then it came 12 years later, all of a sudden this pops up again, and it's like, okay, where's that supposed to go? And I think the other thing is I have to walk a very fine line leading a charity, because it's a secular charity.
Right.
I am desperate for secular charities that are efficient, that are working in orphan care and clean water, et cetera, that we can invest in. Because most of the charities, particularly the ones in the beginning, are faith-based.
Right
there. And it's hard to talk to retailers and other folks about that. So we are, you know, I'm a Christian. However, the organization is a secular organization.
Right.
And we work with all kinds of charities. And I'm sure that in most people's lives, it's very similar type of thing. You've got to walk a fine line there. So I've got to be respectful of all those things. So yeah, your our faith light and what God wants us to do permeates all of that, and that will open up doors. But I think too often when we think about it, we think it's a very big, bold push of our faith in the work area. My favorite so-called witnessing thing is not me talking, but it's in, I think it's 1 Peter 3:15. Always give a reason for the hope that you have. Always have a reason for that. If people ask, if they see my life and they ask, okay, then I'm gonna share it with them. But that's not what I do. And so with the secular organization, we have to lead with the social aspect of it. And if the delivery mechanism is a faith mechanism or not, it doesn't matter to us. We've had trips that have been to places that are Christian projects that are atheist, Hindu, Jewish, or whatever. And when we focused on the social good aspect of it, we haven't had anybody issues, so we don't have the proselytizing. But there's an opportunity to impact if the goal is evangelism there. So it's a fine line, and it's understanding that it is a struggle. There have been times where I've wanted to chuck it and just say, you know what, I'm just going to do a purely Christian ministry thing and just do that so I don't have to play both sides of this. There have been other times where I just want to say, you know, let's chuck it all or, you know, type of thing. Very real, but this is where God's got me now.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, That's good stuff, Greg. I really appreciate that. And it just reminds me that even though God may not be doing exactly what you think he needs to be doing, like right now, that he has something out there for you, right?
And his timetable is a lot different than ours. And he's more concerned what's going on in us rather than through us.
Totally. That is so well put. That's so well put. Greg, it's so nice to meet you, man. And
thank you too, Curry. Thanks for having me on.
For sure. Hopefully we'll see each other around, maybe on the, internet or conferences or something.
Yeah, sure. Right, sounds great. All right, man.
Bye-bye. Thanks. Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing Greg's amazing story. Even going back through it again, I just got so much out of it. Just thinking about my life and where I'm at, and just that God has so much more for me than I can ever imagine, that the work he's created me for is important, but it's yet to be seen. And that excites me, and that gives me just hope and peace, I think. And I hope it's the same for you. I love that Greg said at the end, it's more about what he's doing in you than necessarily through you. And I think that's an important lesson for all of us. That we're just praying that God's transforming us, and that we're listening to him, and we're in this conversation with God, not necessarily just about the stuff we do, the money we make, the things that we have. All that stuff comes last in this world of what God wants to do in us, how he wants to transform our heart, how he wants to make us his. And so I think these are important things for us to remember and listen to. And I hope you got that out of Greg's. Make sure and leave me a rating and review if you're still thinking about it. It's right there on the app at the bottom of my feed. You should be able to do it there. And until next time, get out there and hustle.